This meeting's been organised by Islington branch of the Socialist Party, and Comrade Vic Fanny from Glasgow has travelled down here to talk to us all on the subject of Rosa Luxemburg and the life and politics of Rosa Luxemburg, who was a socialist speaker and organiser at the turn of the century. Comrade Fanny is going to speak for about 40 minutes, after which time will be time for questions and discussion and any points that you want to put to him. So I'd like to ask Vic to open this one up.
Well, thanks very much for coming, the chairperson. Now, the subject of tonight's meeting, Rosa Luxemburg, is a comparatively neglected figure. It's only relatively recently that most of her writings and speeches have been translated and become available. But there has been a resurgence of interest in the woman, and this can be demonstrated by the film that was on the rounds earlier this year. And I can recommend anyone who has not yet seen it, if they get the opportunity to see it, I would certainly like the opportunity to see it again. But for the benefit of anybody in the audience who might not know much about Rosa Luxemburg, I think it would be a good idea to provide some brief biographical details of what was by any standard a very, very remarkable woman. She was born in eastern Poland in 1871. Poland at that time, of course, was a part of the Russian Empire, even more than it is today. And she was born into a pretty well-off family. And if she hadn't been the person that she was, she could have lived a conventional provincial life, probably done the things that her parents would have wanted her to do, that is, get married, bring up a family, and so on. But that was not for her. At the age of 16, she became involved in Polish social democracy. And characteristically, so active was she that she soon came to the attention of the authorities. And in those days, that could mean a trip to Siberia. So a decision was taken on her behalf to smuggle her out of Poland to safety. And she was smuggled out, and she went to live in Zurich in Switzerland for several years, and she was still only 17 at this time. Now, that didn't diminish her political activity in any way. In Switzerland, she became, if anything, even more involved, and she was the main contributor to her party's journal, which was, of necessity, published in exile in Paris, and the copies were smuggled back into Poland. And she even found time to attend the University of Zurich and gain her doctorate. And in 1893, when the Congress of the Second International was held in Zurich, she became probably the youngest delegate to the International that had ever been at the age of 22. Now, when you consider just as a measure of how extraordinary she was, when you consider how difficult it is for a woman to make a name for herself in politics in this day and age, consider how much more difficult it must have been in the even more male-dominated Europe of 100 years ago. Anyway, she moved to Germany because she had an eye on the German Social Democratic Party. She wanted to become involved in that. It was, after all, the biggest social democratic party in the whole world, the party that Marx and Engels in their lifetime referred to as our party, a party that could boast such giants of Marxist literature as Babel, Kautsky, Liebknecht, and many others. But even in that exalted company, Rosa Luxemburg quickly made her mark because she was extremely formidable in controversies, and she was no respecter of reputation. It didn't matter how famous an antagonist in debate might be, she didn't pull her punches. Unless you arrived in Germany, the Social Democratic Party in that country was involved, embroiled in the greatest debate that there has ever been in the Social Democratic movement. And that was a debate between, on the one hand, the revisionists, led, for want of a better word, by a man called Edward Bernstein, and on the other hand, the revolutionaries, people like Rosa Luxemburg. And these revisionists were busily attacking the fundamentals of a Marxist theory. They took the viewpoint that the socialist revolution was not necessary to get rid of capitalism, that it could be reformed away bit by bit. And as evidence to back up their case, they cited such things as the fact that through the granting of more democratic rights in Germany, the working class were getting more and more say in national affairs. They pointed to the fact that the trade unions were winning a better life for the working class, both in terms of wages and conditions of work. And they also considered that nationalisation, which at that time was all the rage in Germany, was something that was taken away from the hands of the capitalist class, the economic power that they had. And shades of today, with all the talk about people's capitalism, they also pointed to the growing ownership of shares, the growing ownership of the various enterprises that you had in Germany at that time. So this to them meant that far from what Marx had been arguing, that capital was becoming concentrated into fewer and fewer hands, they said, not so. Capital is becoming concentrated into more and more hands. So all these things together added up to the case for reformism that was being expounded by those people who looked to Edward Bernstein. Rosa Luxemburg replied to this attack with a pamphlet, The Form of Revolution, and we can maybe discuss that later on. But in her general political activity, as ever, she pulled no punches, and because of her outspokenness under all circumstances, she was gradually to spend more and more time in prison. Now, as the first decade of the 20th century wore on, a new debate began to make its presence felt in the social democratic movement in Germany. Because Germany had entered on to the world stage comparatively late as an imperialist power. By the time it came onto the scene, the world had pretty well been carved up by the older imperialists such as Britain, France, Holland, and Germany was would do something about that. They took the viewpoint that they were entitled to a share of the action. And with that view in mind, they were very, very busy rearming. And the big debate within the Social Democratic Party in Germany was, what should be the attitude of social democrats towards this? Now, needless to say, Rosa Luxemburg was completely opposed to it. She took the viewpoint this was a squabble between her masters, frankly, and there wasn't one drop of working class blood should be shed because of this. But in the SDP, there were a bunch of prominent people who were in favour of German imperialism. They took the viewpoint that Germany was entitled as much as any other nation to its place in the sun. And this debate came to a head at the outbreak of the First World War, when the German Social Democrat MPs in the Reichstag, of which there were 111, only 15 of them voted against the extension of war credits, which was necessary to finance the German war effort. 15 out of 111. Now, Rosa Luxemburg was shattered by that. But nevertheless, all during the First World War, she wasted no opportunity to hammer those alleged socialists who had, of whatever country, who had thrown in their lot with their national capitalist class. And during the war, she carried on a ceaseless agitation against it. And because of this, she spent longer and longer periods in prison. In fact, the last 3 years of her life, practically, were spent in prison. And she was released only in November 1918 by the so-called German Revolution. What happened in November 1918 was the German military effort collapsed, the monarchy collapsed, and a social democratic government was installed. And Rosa Luxemburg was released from prison. Well, she found herself in a tremendous political turmoil. And in the period between her release and her death, 3 months later, she founded, with the help of others, of course, the German Communist Party. But her ex-comrades in the Social Democratic Party, who were enraged at her activities, both before and after her spell in prison, had put a price on her head. Eventually, she was captured by soldiers who were an auxiliary, believe it or not, of the Social Democratic Party, acting on behalf of the Social Democratic government. That was in January 1919. And very soon after her capture, she was murdered at the age of 47. Now, what has been the attitude of the Socialist Party of Great Britain down the years towards Rosa Luxemburg? Well, come the fact is that the party had a great many kind words to say about her. From the very earliest days of the publication of the Socialist Standard, incidentally, there were a lot of kind words to say about a lot of other European social democrats who were not nearly as worthy of those words as Rosa Luxemburg was. As a for example, here's an article that was printed in the January edition 1907 of the Socialist Standard, absolutely in those days. The article is entitled Right and Revolution, and it consists almost entirely of a speech by Rosa Luxemburg on trial for inciting to riot. The prosecution made their case. They quoted statements that she'd made, and they said, "All this amounts to an incitement to the use of physical force. Her words were such as to create excitement among the masses." Now, the article consists of 4 columns, 3 of which are devoted to her defence of herself. And I don't know how it looked in the original, but even translated into the English language, you can see what a brilliant wordsmith she was. Here's part of her defence of herself. Referring to this one about her attempts to stir up the working class to violence, she pointed out that the workers are provoked to rebellion daily, not only by words, but by deeds. Do you believe that masses of people could be incited to use physical force against the ruling class merely by a few words on the revolution, when you consider that those same masses kept their temper admirably all the time the capitalist class enforced their anti-socialist law, their penal servitude enactments directed against free speech and press, their measures for increasing working class starvation, and last but not least, their bill for smashing up the workers' economic organisation. I am surprised that the public prosecutor has not, instead of prosecuting me, brought to book the originators of these laws and bills. For these deeds are apt to stir up immensely the the propertyless masses and would most certainly lead to physical force excesses if it were not for socialism's enlightening and elevating influence. Now, come with the chairman. It's hard for us in the Socialist Party not to warn towards somebody that uses words like that. And in conclusion of her defence, she says, "And now, in conclusion, I ask you to acquit me, not because I am afraid of the imprisonment to which you may treat me. If it is a question of enduring the punishment meted out to us by the ruling class for our convictions, every socialist submits to it with the greatest indifference." Now, the writer of the article had signed himself H.G.I.N., that was the Hans Neumann, a German member living in Britain. He was a founder member of the Socialist Party of Great Britain. He concludes his article, "Well done, Red Rosa. You have grandly expressed the sentiments of the class-conscious workers of the world, and may you live to see the social revolution accomplished." I can't think of a finer sentiment for a socialist to offer another member of the human race. And later on, in 1939, just to prove the point that the Socialist Party does regard Rosa Luxemburg in a way that we certainly don't regard the likes of Lenin, Trotsky, and all the other heroes in the leftist pantheon, another writer in 1939 rages, I think that's the word, at the claim made by the Communist International that Rosa Luxemburg belongs to them, an insult to the memory of one of the finest individuals who ever championed the cause of the working class. Now, if anybody in the audience thinks that's maybe putting it a bit strongly, I should point out that article too was written by a member of German extraction. So we have the greatest respect for the courage, ability and integrity of Rosa Luxemburg. But nevertheless, we are in opposition to a great deal of our general political outlook. And in order to explain this, I think it would be necessary to deal with the case of the Socialist Party of Great Britain briefly again, by explaining what we mean by socialism and how we envisage it being achieved. For us, socialism is the next stage in social development. It's a new society which will solve the problems of capitalism, not by patching or shoring it up, as the revisionists wanted to do, but by abolishing it completely, by replacing it entirely. We see it as a worldwide system of common ownership and democratic control, where the whole world's population will own in common, democratically control, all the places where wealth is produced and distributed. That's just a way of saying the factories, the land, the communications and transport systems. We see it as a worldwide society. We don't think that there's any national solution to the problems of capitalism. There's no bolt hole that say that the working class of Great Britain could go to in order to escape the problems of that system. The problem is a worldwide one in nature. Therefore, it must have a worldwide solution. It would be a system of society where there'd be no employer-employee relationship, where the capitalist class would have been abolished. Consequently, nobody to employ a working class. No wages, because there'd be no capitalist class. No exchange relationships. No buying and selling between owners and non-owners. And accordingly, it follows on from that. No money, no prices, no pensions, insurance schemes, banks, etc. And all the other things that are so necessary inside capitalism society. A world of free access, in short, from each according to his ability, to each according to his or her needs. Now that system of society is, we say, possible today. But the conditions for it are present, with one exception, which I'll deal with in a minute. For example, the means of production and distribution have been developed by capitalism to the extent where the problem of production long since been solved. Today, in terms of technology, mankind is capable of producing an abundance over and over for every human being on the earth and more. When you take into account that the working class, unlike in Karl Marx's day or even in Rosa Luxemburg's day, the working class is now the vast majority of humanity and are the economically important class, then you can see that those certain requirements for socialism, with the exception of the one I'll talk about in a minute, have already been fulfilled. Now what's holding us back is simply the lack of socialist consciousness on the part of the working class. But the majority of the working class of the world must favour socialism before it can be established. I mean, in this room tonight, come the chairman, we can perhaps disagree of various things, but surely nobody thinks that socialism can be established over the heads of an unwilling majority. Without working class being in favour of socialism, then there can be no socialism. Now, Rosa Luxemburg agreed with that proposition. There's no question about it. She knew that this is what socialism meant. Unfortunately, there was a fatal flaw that came into her thinking, because she took the view, along with the German Social Democratic Party, that they must support a programme of reforms in order to gain working class support. It's a viewpoint that's very, very common today among the contemporary left-wingers. They say that by gaining various reforms, which they say will be a benefit to the working class, these victories will encourage the working class to recognise their own strength and will then go on to apply the strength to the wider struggle for the abolition of capitalism and its replacement by socialism. Now, it sounds wonderful. It sounds so simple. But the plain fact of the matter is that it doesn't work that way. History has shown us that it doesn't work that way. History has shown us that whatever workers vote for a reform or a programme of reforms, if they achieve those things, then that's then satisfied. There's no evidence to show that they then go on as a section of the working class to be in favour of the abolition of capitalism. And moreover, a programme of reforms also encourages all sorts of people who are interested in the achieving of reforms, reformists. And if they think that a political party has got a chance of enacting those reforms, then that's the one for them. In Germany, because of the SDP's programme of reforms, reformists swarmed in from all directions, to such an extent that the genuine socialist minority was soon swamped. And preoccupation with reforms dominated the Social Democratic Party's activity and thinking, to such an extent that the aim, which had been socialism, was forgotten, and that the means of reforms became the aims themselves. Now, Rosa Luxemburg complained about this. She fought it bitterly. After all, surely that's the logical result of an alleged socialist party having a programme of reforms. Also, she'd spent 20 years of her life crossing Germany from east to west and north to south and back again, speaking and organizing on behalf of that party. And she must have known the nature of that party. You see, when the Socialist Party of Great Britain was formed in 1904, in its early days, the founder members tended to exaggerate the socialist content of the social democrats in Europe. But at least it was an excuse for them. They were living hundreds of miles away and didn't have access to all that was going on in a country like Germany. But Rosa Luxemburg was right on the spot. Within about 5 years of the founding of the Socialist Party, those early members had seen through the social democrats of Europe. They'd seen through them. References in the Socialist Standard to our comrades around about 1910 became replaced with a bitter denunciation. So Rosa Luxemburg should have known from her own personal experience that the Marxism of the SDP was merely a fig leaf, and that what Bernstein was trying to do was just to legitimise, to have recognised something that already existed, in fact, and that was that the SDP was a reformist party. What Bernstein was saying, in effect, was, look, we're a reformist party. That's the basis on which people join us. It's the basis on which people vote for us. So why make things difficult for ourselves? Why frighten people away who could be attracted to us with all this revolutionary rhetoric? Let's forget about it. And he was right. He recognised the SDP for what it was. He'd come to terms with it. Rosa Luxemburg had not. I mean, if the SDP was not a reformist organisation, then how do we explain away the fact that it had over 100 MPs in the Reichstag? Would anybody here seriously suggest that they had been elected on a programme of the abolition of capitalism, the sweeping away of classes, the sweeping away of national boundaries, the sweeping away of the wages system, and all the rest of it? If the SDP had stood on that basis, there wouldn't have been 100 MPs there, there wouldn't have been one. So we come then to Rosa Luxemburg's release from prison and their involvement in the rising that was staged at the tail end of the beginning of 1919 by the German Communist Party, known as the Spartacists. Now, how did she get involved in that? After all, she was forever telling her co-thinker and co-worker, Karl Liebknecht, that the conditions were not right, that the German working class weren't ready for socialism. And she was aided in this by her undoubted knowledge of the materialist conception of history. It showed her, yes, that the conditions for the revolution were not there. And what was that situation in Germany, say, at the tail end of 1918? As I pointed out earlier, Germany had been defeated militarily, the monarchy had been toppled, and an SDP government had been installed. Germany was swarming with disillusioned members of the armed forces, some of whom were in open rebellion. The soldiers were stuck in camps, and the sailors were stuck in ship and harbour, and all of them wanted to get home. And in the cities, the working class were in a state of semi-starvation. Now, I just want to recap for a minute here. Remember what the case of the Socialist Party of Great Britain is. Socialism is only possible when the majority understands it and are in favour of it. Now, was that the case in Germany at that time? For one thing, the German working class were as patriotic as their counterparts in Great Britain. In fact, that was the reason that those German social democrats gave in 1914 for voting for war credits. They said it, and rightly, that if they had voted for the war credits, they would have lost any support that the German social democrats had at that time. They were being realistic. Also, Germany, although it was a mighty industrial nation, was to a great extent still an agricultural nation. A very, very large percentage of the population still lived through agriculture. Small peasants, people like that, they weren't revolutionary. In fact, they were very, very conservative. Indeed, so not only was there not a majority for socialism, but there wasn't even a majority for whatever it was that the Spartacists wanted. So why did Rosa Luxemburg then get involved in that uprising? And I think the answer is that it was because of her belief in the theory of the collapse of capitalism. Now that's a viewpoint she'd held pretty well all her life, that capitalism would at some point collapse under the weight of its own contradictions, especially if there was a period of intense dislocation such as existed in Germany at that time. She took the viewpoint that this was the collapse, the long-awaited collapse of capitalism, and it was necessary for the German communists to grab the chance and, of course, to copy what the Bolsheviks had done in Russia 2 years previously. Now, come with Germany, they were in a hopeless position. Because despite whatever case there was in Germany that time, the fact is that the government was still in control. It still had the loyalty of the vast bulk of the armed forces. It still controlled the state apparatus. So it was a question of the state versus a handful of Spartacists armed with rifles. They were easily smashed because they mistook this dislocation in Germany caused by the end of the war for a revolutionary situation. So Rosa Luxemburg then was as wrong in revolution as she had been on reforms. So here's this woman who's got all these undoubted qualities: bravery, honesty, intelligence. No doubt about that. But is it enough? Now, while she was dazzling everybody on the continent, there was a small group of men and women here in Great Britain who could see things far more clearly than ever she could. I'm referring, of course, to the founder members of the Socialist Party of Great Britain. Now, these men and women, the men were the brickies, painters, clerks, as often as not unemployed. The women, they were typists, shop assistants, housewives, and so on. The kind of people that nobody's ever made a film about up till now, and who are usually ignored in the history books. But they knew this much: the certain reforms of capitalism are necessary before socialism can become a practical proposition. No question about that. Obvious examples: the need for a political legality, what is at least possible for a socialist movement to organise openly, to publish its literature, speak at meetings, disseminate propaganda. The need for the working class to get the vote, so that at least it's demonstrated that it's reached a certain level of political maturity, that at least has got the opportunity to take its fate into its own hands. And also universal education, where the working class can at least be educated to the extent where they can consider the socialist case whenever it's presented to them. And of course, the right to organise into independent trade unions. Because if the working class can't even do that, then it will never be fit to bring about the socialist revolution. Now, all these vital reforms have long since been achieved. We say that a point has been reached in history where it's not more reforms that we want. But what's necessary now is for a genuine socialist party to put forward the case for revolution. The revolution now becomes that practical possibility that I mentioned a minute or two ago. The campaigning for even more reforms, far from being an aid to the development of socialist ideas, becomes a diversion. It's not a lack of reforms that's holding back the growth of socialist ideas. It's the fact that there isn't a big enough socialist organisation that can undertake the task of getting the ideas of the abolition of capitalism, the end of classes, the end of exchange relationships, taken seriously. Capitalism throws up tremendous discontent within the working class. The need is for a socialist party to undertake the necessary propaganda to take advantage of that situation. And besides knowing that, our founder members knew better than to throw their lives away on any futile heroic gestures. They were clear not only on what socialism is, but on how to bring it about. They knew that if it was going to be a democratic society, it must be brought about democratically. It cannot be brought about by an undemocratic minority trying to overthrow capitalism. The kind of undemocratic minority action such as was undertaken by the Spartacists. Now I'm going to wind up, come the chairman, and I'm going to admit something here. That if Rosa Luxemburg had done what so many other social democrats had done, both before and after her, that is, sought to escape persecution in their own homelands, had come to this country, I think it's extremely unlikely that she would have applied for membership of the Socialist Party of Great Britain. I also think it's even more unlikely that if she had applied for membership, that she would have been admitted. I'm pretty sure that she would not have given the answers that we require to the questions that are asked of every applicant for membership. So although we can admire this brave, intelligent, and immensely able woman, there are these fundamental differences between her and ourselves. No denying she had an excellent knowledge of Marxist theories. Can't take that away from her. But when it came the time to apply those theories, and this is the acid test, she didn't do it. She went off in an entirely different direction, just like so many others again, before and after her. I'm sure that she must have known in her heart what she should have done. What she wanted to do, in fact, and that was to stand aside from that uprising and to concentrate on the only sane thing she could have done in the situation, and that was to try and convince as many members of the working class in Germany as she could to her viewpoint. That would have been the only sane thing to do. Now that's what we in the Socialist Party of Great Britain have been doing for over 80 years. And I'm not making a virtue out of necessity here, because it's not that this is the best way to go about it, it's the only way to go about it. What else could you do in a situation like that? Well, you could do what Rosa Luxemburg and the Spartacists did. Put your neck in the chopping block. But that doesn't aid socialism. That only puts it further back. So those 80 odd years that we've spent putting forward our case, we see as having been the right course to take. And if ever a situation came along in Great Britain when a so-called revolutionary situation presented itself, but without this majority support for socialism, then you would not find, I'm confident, the Socialist Party of Great Britain acting in opposition to the views it has held for those 80 odd years. I'm confident that members in a situation like that will be doing what we've always done, trying to steer the working class away from any rash, foolhardy and dangerous actions, and at all times propagate the case for socialism and nothing but